Hello and welcome to The Corridor here on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario, and podcasting on Spotify and Apple Music. I'm Dinah Jansen, and with me is CFRC Local Journalism Initiative news producer Jesse Bell. This regional news program features news from Kingston and area provided by local and regional journalists through the support of the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Welcome and enjoy. Hello and welcome to The Corridor. I'm Dinah Jansen, and today I'm joined by CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative producer, Jesse Bell. Our first story is from CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative reporter, Christina Laurie, covering the launch of a student-made mental health resource app called Seedle.
Hello, I'm Christina Laurie, Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories in Kingston and the Islands. You can listen to CFRC's news programs Today in YGK and Kingston Currents on Mondays, Tuesdays, and Wednesdays at 5 p.m. or subscribe to our podcasts on Spotify and Apple Music. If you have any Kingston news tips you'd like to share, you can reach me at news@cfrc.ca.
Four Queen's students have launched a mental health tool designed just for students. Seedle.ca is a free, verified directory of supports for university campuses across the country. I sat down with the team to learn how it all started, what they discovered, and their hopes for the future.
My name is Yohanathan Chakargi. I am a second year in health sciences, and I'm responsible for the technology aspect within Seedle.
My name is Tobori Akpoyebe. I am also in second year of health science. I am responsible for marketing.
My name is William Wu. I'm also in second year health sciences, and my role is financially planning the events at Seedle.
My name is Sharman Dabidian. I'm in second year of health sciences, and my role is with the operations of Seedle.
The idea for Seedle began in their first year at Queen's, when the group noticed the struggle that comes with navigating university life and mental health.
Essentially, last year, we all started university, and so we recognized that that was kind of like a time where we had a bunch of new experiences, whether that be through meeting different peoples, different clubs, and so there's a lot of strain. A lot of the time, you can get so immersed within like all the different learnings that you do, and you can kind of put your mental health on a back burner. And so we started talking a little bit, and we recognized it's much, much more common than you'd expect. And so we really wanted to do something about that. And that's where Seedle came from. We really thought, okay, if this is such a recurring problem, how can we make mental health resources more accessible to everybody, especially within the university context?
Each founder took on a role and built a platform that filters resources by category, identity-affirming supports, and more.
The first thing we thought about is making a directory. So essentially, having a place where you'd be able to really see all these resources, especially because you can more so grasp, okay, is there a disparity within this community? Like, can we address that as well? Beyond that, we started thinking, okay, how do we filter out these resources? So whether it's like a BIPOC resource or LGBTQ plus IA, or whether that be a specific type of support, crisis line, community counseling, we thought about filtering as well.
We have various different categories of resources on our website. We have like online resources and in-person resources. And the way that our website really works is that we have specific campuses across Canada the students can choose from, for example, Queen's University. And based off of that campus, there's different resources around them that they can have access to and that they will see. And if it's like an in-person resource, we have a feature where it says like how many kilometers that campus is away from that resource. We provide various different types of categories throughout our depository so that students can really go through these categories and pick a resource that's more tailored and catered towards their mental health needs.
The team says that students are uniquely vulnerable because of factors like workload and change in environment.
I think especially for students, we're always in such a busy time of our lives, whether it's clubs, making new friends, schoolwork, classes. It's always super busy, and people really just put their mental health in the back of their mind. They don't really focus on it. They're just too busy with their work, with their life. Yes, we do all this work as students. Yes, we're so busy, but we also need to be happy with our lives. We need to make sure that we're doing something that we are happy with. And that's why mental health is so important, just to make sure that you are not only being successful, but also that you are happy with the state of life that you have.
The team also pointed to the stigma that comes with discussing mental health and the role of education and institutions in addressing this.
I think a big thing a lot of the time, there is this sort of stigma that's associated with mental health. Somebody could be perceived as weak in that regard because they are looking for that mental health. I think education plays such a fundamental role when it comes to that seeking of support. I think making different awareness campaigns and really just showing that, hey, this is an acceptable thing. You should be reaching out to support because, as Charmin mentioned, success, that's a part of your success in life. It's your whole quality of life is based on the way that you sort of see these things, and having that background and that level of support is so necessary. So I would definitely say when it comes to universities and campuses, more so making it more accessible and more known that, hey, this is totally an option and there's no stigma associated with it.
I was also going to say that's why CETL is so important in that manner in regards, because we provide that resource that universities can go ahead and share. It's really hard to gather these different resources and put them together in a depository, but we've already done that and provided it for the general population. So universities can then use CETL to kind of help educate others also about the different mental health support systems and resources that exist throughout Canada.
While mapping resources across the country, the team uncovered some gaps, especially in Northern and Indigenous communities.
I think there's a diverse variety of resources available for many like students in universities, such as like in Ontario and like British Columbia, for example. But like other provinces and territories, especially the Northern territories, there's a huge like disparity in the resources that they have available. There is not many like helplines. There's not many like community counseling resources. And it's very, very sad that there are these disparities, because especially in the like Northern territories, these communities themselves are highly populated with Indigenous peoples. And it's very unfortunate that these communities are lacking these important mental health services and needs. And that's some disparity that we've realized that exists. And that's something we also want to address.
Moving forward, using their database, the team wants to work with universities and governments to fill these gaps and improve access to mental health resources nationwide.
One thing that we've realized is by kind of making a list of like resources, we can also figure out what's missing from these communities. If we have XYZ resources in this community, we also know, oh, we're missing this resource. So by figuring out these disparities, we can kind of do a study and see, oh, these different university campuses, these different cities are missing these resources. So we should be collaborating with the government, collaborating with these universities so that we can expand and make sure that these missing resources are filled in so that all students have access to all different types of resources for their mental health needs. And an example of this is like Indigenous specific resources. There are some universities that are lacking these resources. So a next step would be to reach out to these universities and say, oh, your city is lacking like Indigenous specific resources for mental health. We need to do something about this. This is a huge problem. And how can we go forward? So that's kind of the next step and next kind of vision that we have with CETL and what we plan on doing in the future.
Yeah, for sure. I agree. I think something that's important is we are trying to build that trust and that rapport with a bunch of different universities and students, because I think something that's super important is knowing that these resources are ethical and verified, and they're very accurate to these different needs. So I think, yeah, something we do want to work on in the future as well is more so building that rapport, expanding on it.
In response to feedback from students, the CETL team is also looking into adding OHIP and UHIP coverage information to make costs clearer. Once again, CETL.ca is free, no login, and already being used on multiple campuses. The team hopes it becomes a trusted tool and a catalyst for change in student mental health support. For more information, you can visit CETL.ca. For CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative, this has been Christina Laurie.
Thank you, Chris. Next is Dinah Jansen with a story from the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for The Kingstonist, Michelle Dory Forestell, about the aftermath of the fire at 46 Montreal Street.
Thank you, Jesse. It's been 2 weeks since firefighters rescued six people after a fire broke out in an apartment building at 46 Montreal Street in Kingston, and displaced tenants are still navigating social agency help to find safe places to stay. The fire started just before 3:30 p.m. on Wednesday, November 26th. Crews from Kingston Fire and Rescue stations were dispatched to 46 Montreal Street at the corner of Montreal and Queen. Upon arrival, they found flames coming from the rear of the building with smoke filling the downtown core. Since then, an entire floor of the building has been closed off to residents due to safety concerns, leaving the tenants precariously housed. According to KFR, fire prevention officers were brought in to determine the cause of the incident, and the damage is estimated at $500,000. According to Anthony Colangeli, Kingston Police's media relations officer, Kingston Police only attended the building on the day of the fire to assist with traffic and closing the roadway. Asked whether they were investigating the fire, he said there was no indication of criminal or suspicious elements in the incident. The fire marshal was not called in, according to Kingston Fire Services, whose spokesperson said the fire department will not disclose any further information about the fire, including the number of tenants displaced. Kevin Smith, who lived on the third floor of the building, recounted his experience on the day of the fire. Smith claimed that the fire was started by a candle lit by one of the tenants on the third floor. Smith heard several shots of fire and ran outside. Once outside, he began experiencing chest pains and lightheadedness, he said, due to congenital heart issues. Smith expressed frustration that emergency medical help was significantly delayed, noting that police arrived first, followed by fire crews, and that he had to insist on receiving medical attention despite what he said were apparent symptoms of smoke inhalation. Eventually, though, ambulances arrived, and he reports that he was the only resident transported to hospital and soon released. Smith described longstanding safety and maintenance issues within the building, including bug infestations, unsafe stairwells, and structural gaps that allowed pests to enter units. Following the fire, Smith said displaced tenants were initially assisted by the Red Cross and placed temporarily in local hotels. However, Smith reported that the support was short-term and inconsistent, and that coordination among relief organizations, including home-based housing, has been uneven, with some tenants receiving support and others not contacted at all. Although Smith said the Salvation Army has suggested he may be placed by January 1st, he remains skeptical given his experience. Joanne Rustin, the co-owner of Suits Nightclub, who also assists the building owners in tenant management, said she is frustrated with how the media covered the fire. She stressed that her nightclub was never involved in the fire, as most media outlets portrayed. There was only a small amount of water damage that has since been repaired. She confirmed the fire was in a residential unit on the third floor of 46 Montreal Street and added that she believed that the fire was caused in part by a hoarding situation involving one of the building's tenants. Rustin explained that she had understood this tenant had support in place to help him live independently, but that didn't materialize in her opinion. Rustin noted that some of the building's tenants are back in their units, but the third floor tenants are still locked out at the time of the Kingstonist publication of the story. And thank you to Michelle Dory Forestell for this story. Over to Jesse Bell with the 2025 Kingston Sports Recap.
Thank you, Dinah. 2025 was an eventful year for Kingston sports, with several local programs exceeding preseason expectations. We'll begin with the Kingston Frontenacs, who had a breakout 2024 and 2025 season, putting up impressive point totals and setting a new franchise record for consecutive home victories with 16. This strong home performance powered the Fronts to a third place finish in the OHL's Eastern Conference with 88 points. Kingston would win their first-round playoff series in dominant fashion before falling to the Barry Colts in 7 games in the OHL semifinals. 2025 also proved to be a fruitful year for athletics at Queen's University. It began with the men's hockey team, who actually started 2025 with back-to-back losses before going on an impressive run in the OUA playoffs. They would beat the University of Toronto Varsity Blues to finish third in the conference and qualify for nationals. They would fall to the University of Saskatchewan Huskies in the national quarterfinals by a score of 4-2. It was another dominant year for the Queen's rugby program, as both the men's and women's teams made it to nationals. The men's team qualified by finishing second in the conference, losing their OUA title game to Guelph, and the women's team, well, they flat out dominated everybody in their conference, winning another conference championship before eventually falling in the semifinals to eventual national champion UBC. Last but certainly not least, the Queen's Gaels football team had an outstanding, historic 2025. The year began with multiple Queens players being selected in the CFL draft, including defensive tackle Darian Newell, defensive end Silas Hubert, and defensive back Ashton Miller-Malençon. Queens football would then brush shoulders with the pros in May, as Richardson Stadium played host to the Ottawa Redblacks CFL training camp. All of this was a prelude to an eventful regular season that saw Queens clinch their fifth straight winning season with a 5-3 record. This was the third time in program history that Queens accomplished this feat, and the first time since 1992. Queens would steamroll McMaster in the OUA quarterfinals and earn a shot at the number 3-seeded Windsor Lancers on the road. After a back-and-forth battle, Queens would pull away in the fourth quarter thanks to 2 touchdowns from Jared Kasari. Queens clinched their 3rd Yates Cup appearance in 5 seasons, where they would have to travel to Waterloo to play the number 1-ranked team in the country, the reigning and defending Yates Cup champion Laurier Golden Hawks. Queens took a 27-3 lead into halftime in the Yates Cup off the back of an outstanding defensive performance. Laurier would close the gap to 3 in the second half, but the Queens defense would hold firm thanks in no small part to a Stephen Capea sack and a John Korskaden pass breakup. Queens would ice the game with a first down run to clinch their first Yates Cup in 16 years with a 30-27 victory. Unfortunately, Queens would lose to the Saskatchewan Huskies the following week, but that loss did little to dampen the energy around this program as it rides high into 2026.
Thank you, Jesse. And now over to the LJI reporter for CJAI-FM, Amherst Island Radio, Ted Evans, with an update on the proposed development of Habitat for Humanity housing units in Loyalist Township.
Hi, I'm Ted Evans, local journalism initiative reporter and news director at CJAI, Amherst Island Radio, 101.3 FM in Stella, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories from Loyalist Township. You can hear Amherst Island Radio's news program, North Shore News, on 101.3 Amherst Island Radio or online at cjai.ca. For showtimes throughout the week, check the schedule on our website at cjai.ca.
Habitat for Humanity's plan for bringing affordable units to Bath has moved another step closer to becoming a reality. At their meeting this week, Loyalist Township Council approved an affordable housing development agreement to donate a portion of land on Church Street in Bath to Habitat for Humanity. The township will be donating approximately 0.5 acre of serviced and rezoned land to the organization, valued at an estimated $277,500, by using money the township received through the Housing Accelerator Fund. Staff look to propose mixed uses on the Church Street property, including affordable rental units owned and operated by Lennox and Addington County. The donated land is expected to be enough to accommodate 1 block of 4 townhomes, which could be built before the Housing Accelerator Fund's deadline in December of 2027, with another block of 4 townhomes to be built by 2030. Based on Habitat for Humanity's presentation at Council's November 25th meeting, staff's report noted the proposed development can be compatible and complementary to the other potential uses. Staff will also be issuing a preliminary expression of interest in January 2026 to gauge interest from other developers for portions of the land to be sold on the open market. According to staff's report, the potential housing projects proposed by both the county and Habitat for Humanity are in alignment with the township's strategic plan balanced growth objective to support more affordable and attainable local housing. These land donations towards the development of affordable housing would also advance 2 of the township's Housing Accelerator Fund initiatives included within their approved action plan. Councillor Paul Proderick showed his support for the project.
I would just say that this is a small piece of our strategic plan, and it's good to see the Habitat for Humanity project, and that hopefully students from our local high school will be involved in the building. We need not only homes, we need builders too.
For Amherst Island Radio and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Ted Evans.
Thank you to Ted Evans for that story. Over to the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFWN, Dan Jones, with a story about the proposed amalgamation of 36 conservation authorities into 7 and the impact it could have on the Ganaraska Region Conservation Authority.
Hi, I'm Dan Jones with CFWN in Cobourg, Ontario. The Ganaraska Region Conservation Authority is raising concerns about proposed Ontario government legislation to merge conservation authorities. CAO and Secretary Treasurer Linda Laliberti says covering a large geographical area may compromise environmental stewardship, yet the province says this will streamline services and quicken approval processes for infrastructure projects.
There are several concerns. One is just the whole explanation as to why this is necessary. The Ontario government is proposing that conservation authorities move from 36 to 7 regional conservation authorities. And I think the concern of Ganaraska's, as well as many other conservation authorities, is by moving into this regionally based area, an area for our consolidation, which includes 7 conservation authorities. We will actually move into an area that is that services the size of, you know, an area larger than the island of Jamaica. And so we'll lose that local, we feel we'll lose that local connection, the local community connection, the residents. We're able to deal with, you know, the people within our watershed much easier than we would be able to deal with on a regionally based, and including our municipalities. We feel that the municipalities will also lose that service delivery that we provide to them. We have 7 municipalities in whole or in part within our watershed, and this the regional proposal is 48 conservation authorities. Or sorry, 48 municipalities. So it's certainly going from you know, a larger area, and we believe that some efficiencies as well as effectiveness of services will be lost.
Now, according to the provincial press release, in when they introduced the legislation, or their intent to introduce the legislation, rather. The province indicated that they wanted to streamline services as well as bring there was a concern from the province that some of the watersheds or some of the conservation authorities, rather, may not have the same capacity as others, and therefore it's not providing consistent services across the board. Have you found that there is that level of concern? And what's your take on the streamlined services?
So I can speak to Ganaraska. There are guidelines that are set out for such as our permitting and other services that we provide. Ganaraska, we are a fully staffed organization with expertise in all areas. And what areas, if we don't have any, we're not... we very often will share staff with some of our neighboring conservation authorities to bring to either provide that expertise to them or to bring that expertise in. So, I mean, those types of efficiencies we're already doing. So when the government says that they're trying to streamline and standardize service delivery by setting these provincial-wide standards, that's great. We totally agree with that. And developing, you know, a single digital platform, again, fine with that. But it can be done without consolidating into these larger 7. There are certainly, there could be some of the smaller organizations that maybe need, you know, need more assistance or maybe could benefit by an amalgamation with another conservation authority, but certainly not on these regional. And as I said, Ganaraska is already meeting those timelines. We're meeting them and exceeding them.
So what's your opinion on a possible staff reductions then or changes if the amalgamation does go forward?
We have been told by the province when the announcement was made to us on October 31st by the minister that we were informed at that time that there would be no loss of jobs. And it is also our understanding that the for instance, the Ganaraska Region Conservation Authority would remain as an office. There would be an office currently where we are. So that's not necessarily the concern at this point because they have said that. But in saying that, I'm not sure where if the efficiencies as far as fiscally responsible, like because we're creating this other agency now, where is there going to be a cost savings, if any, or at least with this consolidation?
Now, in your discussions with the province and the minister, or maybe even the minister's office or the department itself, what are they saying in terms of what the legislation will look like in terms of maybe the board structure, but also the on-the-ground structure?
That has not been told to us. There's announcements all the time. We're in meetings with them. They're asking for feedback. All we know at this point is after the municipal election, we have been informed, this may change, that after the October 2026 election, our board of directors will no longer be appointed to our board by the municipalities, and there will be the Ontario Provincial Conservation Agency, which that legislation, the Conservation Authorities Act, the changes to that has already received royal assent. So those changes, as far as the creation of this Ontario Provincial Conservation Authority, will happen. But that agency will have staff. It will also have a board of directors. But beyond the governance, we have not been made aware of what those specific models are going to be for the proposed regional conservation authority so that we, Ganoraska, would be a part of.
Now, the public may say, okay, some of these changes, they may not see these changes or notice those changes, but are you concerned that the public will see real on-the-ground environmental changes due to this proposed legislation?
Absolutely. Absolutely. When you take an area as large as what's being proposed and put it into a regional service delivery area, there will be probably a different hoops or different red tape to go through. And I don't think that we believe that the efficiencies of service delivery in that larger organization will not happen as it does with the smaller organizations.
So will this compromise environmental stewardship then?
It very well could. Absolutely. We don't know what programs will be acceptable to the agency, and if our stewardship programs will continue. We are hoping that our stewardship programs, such as our Clean Water, Healthy Lands program, our tree planting, we're hoping those, stay in what form. We're not sure. We're not sure of what will happen.
So what are the next steps for you in the Ganoraska Conservation Authority?
Well, at our board meeting on November 27th, the board created a response to the consolidation. We are now putting it in a form to comment on the environmental registry posting, and we will be that is open until December 22nd. So we will be putting those comments together and submitting those prior to December 22nd, and any member of the public is invited to make those comments. It's an ERO posting, 025-1257, and there are members of the public that we've been copied on that are certainly saying, Ganoraska Region Conservation Authority is delivering the services. We're being efficient. Any permits, any inquiries, anything that we're very timely, and any such consolidation could jeopardize that service delivery.
Reporting for CFWN and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Dan Jones.
And thank you to Dan Jones for that story. Next up is Jesse Bell with CFRC's Environment Canada weather forecast for the Kingston region.
Thank you, Dinah. This is your Environment Canada weather report for the week. Thursday, December 18th, we're going to see a daytime high of 6 degrees with a 70% chance of precipitation in the forecast. Largely, that's going to be rain, but as things get cooler in the evening, it could see a bit of freezing rain in the forecast as well. Friday, December 19th, daytime high of 2 degrees with sun in the forecast. Saturday, December 20th, daytime high of 1, overnight low of minus 3, feeling closer to minus 8. Sunday, December 21st, daytime high of minus 1, but it's going to feel closer to minus 5, so bear that in mind. And then at the start of next week, Monday, December 22nd, high of 0, low of minus 6, but it will actually feel a little above freezing, around 2 degrees or so during the day.
And that's a wrap for this week's edition of The Corridor, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Don't forget to visit CFRC.ca for the latest in local and regional news headlines, concert and events listings, and more. You can also follow CFRC on Facebook and Instagram at CFRC Music and on Twitter X at CFRC. You can support CFRC and its independent news programming by donating via CFRC.ca. We'll be back next week with more in local and regional news. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for listening to this podcast produced at CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, situated on the traditional territories of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples, and brought to you by the generous support of Smith Engineering.